Track session number 12401, Reel 4.
Colonel Mander, Reel 4. What I had in mind was, did you ever capture any of their flags, or insignia, or anything of that kind?
The greatest booty to capture was a communist cap, a bandit cap. And I know when I, just before I left the battalion, I was presented with a bandit cap by one of the companies. I felt that was a very great honor, because a bandit cap was the most terrific thing to have captured. We captured documents, clothing, boots, weapons, food, cooking pots, everything you can think of. We went into their camps, and everything that we couldn't carry out, we burnt or destroyed.
Did the enemy seem to be starving, or were they well provided with food?
They were starving the time we'd finished with them. But they were, we did sometimes capture quite large quantities of food. And of course, one of the great tactical things that we tried to do was to prevent them getting food, and preventing them getting at the local population, either to get food or to indoctrinate them or terrorize them or kill them or anything else. You better keep them away from the local people.
What evidence did you have that they were starving towards the end?
Well, surrenders mainly. People coming in, surrendering, say they on one occasion we killed two or three people, and in the cooking pot we found boiled grass and banana leaves and things like that. They'd had nothing to eat except this sort of stuff for several days, and they were absolutely starving. So we did have evidence that our tactics and our modus operandi was working.
When you captured the food, what was it? Rice?
Yes.
Anything else?
Fish and rice, mainly. Particularly dried fish. And, of course, a certain amount of fruit. Bananas or something like that. They might have got. Mainly fish and rice.
Did the location of the camps ever surprise you? Did they turn out to be in surprising places?
Nothing surprised one with these communists, really. If they had had a little camp within 100 yards of my bungalow, it wouldn't have surprised me very much, I don't think. They were able to live in the jungle. They had been living in the jungle, in the woods, and intermingle with the local people. I think when we did a search in Tampin, we had a real good clean out of Tampin. We caught one or two communists living in Tampin itself. And informers and so on, well, we caught them in this clean out of Tampin. So nothing really surprised one with them. One was ready and had to expect that anything might happen.
But how could you identify them as enemy?
Well, the police could. Who are you? Where do you come from? Where's your house? Where's your wife? Where, you know, and he couldn't identify himself. And somebody would say, that chap's a bandit. He came into my house demanding food, and his rifle is hidden in a tree or something like that. Given away. But we had a bad ambush on the railway, the only bad one when we were there, and as a result of that we had a bit of a clean out in Tampin, and we closed the entire town off, shut it all up. We did the closing down, let nobody in, let nobody out, and then the police and the people went through people one by one after another, everybody in the town. Everybody had to identify themselves, who they were, and we got quite a few people. The police did.
What happened on that ambush?
The Sultan of somewhere, Johor, I think, was traveling in the train, and they blew it up and did quite a lot of damage, and we had to go down there and sort of sort them out and send down the doctor and transport people about and generally deal with the situation and send out to try and see if we could catch the people who've done it and so on and so forth. But it was blown up not so very far from Tampin, somewhere between Tampin and Johor, on its way to Tampin. And the fact that it had a Malay ruler on board made it rather important. And otherwise, if it had been any other train, perhaps there wouldn't have been so much fuss made about it.
Did you have anything to do with the Minyuan?
Minyuan sounds a bit like Indochina, doesn't it?
The supporters of the people who were supporting the guerrillas, yes, but weren't actually fighting themselves, but providing them with information and so on. Or was that just a police job?
Well, anyone who was supporting the bandits, we were against. Yes, we fought the war on their lines of communication, as you might say. So we were very much onto the Minyuan and the people who were supplying the bandits. And if we had an area where we thought the bandits were supplying them, I might send out a platoon there, and the platoon headquarters would be in the settlement, with perhaps a 2-inch mortar or something like that, and the soldiers would go out at night or in the evening and into the jungle. Nobody knew where they were, and they would be ambushing the likely lines of approach, and so people in the headquarters knew we were there and knew that we were in the jungle roundabout but didn't know where, and the communists would not be able to come in because they would probably get to know that we were there too. So it was a war against their attempts to terrorize the Chinese and to feed themselves. It was all the same war, wasn't it?
Did you ever lose any equipment to the guerrillas, like rifles or ammunition or anything of that kind?
Not to the bandits, but on one occasion the whole of battalion headquarters was under about 3 feet of water, torrential rain, and some piece of equipment was missing from the signal tent. I forget whether it was a wireless set or a pair of binoculars or something like that. So I reported to brigade headquarters that this piece of equipment was missing, and the brigadier told me I should pay for it because it was my responsibility to see that things were not missing from the camp. I was very upset about that. I was told I had to pay 10 quid or something for some bit of equipment which had been lost in a flood at battalion headquarters. I don't remember anything else being lost. No, we didn't lose any rifles or anything like that in action. But, of course, things did fall off lorries, and I'm sure we had the odd thing went missing. Certainly it did.
So did you pay for it?
Yes, 10 quid.
You mentioned
under protest.
You mentioned the Sakai. Why were you interested in the Sakai?
Well, they lived in the jungle, and they might be able to help us find the bandits. And the bandits would get on to anybody who could supply them with food or information. So the Sakai were, like the Chinese or the Malays or anyone else, a target that the bandits might attack, terrorize, or make use of. So we'd have to try and protect them.
What did you feel about the Sakai yourself?
They were very, very primitive people, and I came to the conclusion that they would be of very little help to the bandits because they had very little food. Very interesting people. They felled an area of jungle and they burnt all the trees and they cultivated it for a year or two. Then all the goodness went out of the soil and they moved away and felled another area of jungle and burnt all the trees and cultivated it.
If we could please say something about something earlier in your career, at the time of Indian independence. I think that you were with the 2nd Battalion, the Green Howards, in Calcutta.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you were called out to that?
Again, I was actually in Berlin, in military government, as a German-speaking officer who knew something about the Germans, and I was told that it was about time I got back to a bit of regimental duty. And since the 1st Battalion was coming to Berlin, I thought I would be joining that. But when I got my posting orders, it was to the 2nd Battalion, the Green Howards, in a place called Barrackpore, which also began with B, but didn't have any other clear connection with Berlin. In Barrackpore, the battalion was engaged in trying to quell the riots which were caused by the imminent independence of India, Muslims trying to kill Hindus, Hindus trying to kill Muslims, and we had to be the man in the middle and trying to prevent them doing that. I had never been in India before. I didn't know anything about riots or anything else, and again, I was pitchforked straight into this situation where the battalion would go in and have to try and deal with these riotous people whose language I couldn't speak and I didn't know anything about them. But there again, nobody was shooting at us. We were just trying to prevent them killing one another, and so it wasn't too difficult a job, and it wasn't anything that you could make an awful mess of. That's how it was that I got there, and we stayed in Calcutta witnessing and trying to prevent the most appalling slaughters, really ghastly, where a whole area of Hindus would be surrounded by Muslims and they would slaughter every single one and slit the stomachs open of pregnant women and that sort of thing. And we would have to go in the morning and try and clean up the mess because we hadn't been able to stop it happening in the middle of the night. And then, of course, the Hindus would exact their revenge on some Muslims somewhere else the following night. And this awful slaughter, anything up to 400 or 500 killed in any night, was going on all the time, and we had to try and stop it. Calcutta, the monsoon broke, the roads around battalion headquarters were just about knee-deep in filthy water, and we were living in the bustees and the slum areas of Calcutta, trying to keep these areas quiet and stop the awful riots taking place. It wasn't a very jolly job, but the soldiers did it, and I think the battalion acquitted itself fairly well. At that time, Mr. Bevin was sending home anything up to 200 or 300 of our soldiers home to England, time expired, and we would get 200 or 300 soldiers from another regiment, and they would be sent to us because the rest of the battalion was going home. So you can imagine how keen they were to come to us and stay in India when all their friends were going home. It was a time when it was very difficult to, after the war, to keep up the keenness and the motivation of soldiers, and Later on in Khartoum, when we went from India to Khartoum, I think I had about the most difficult time that I can ever remember with a battalion which consisted of people who just wanted to get home, and we were filled up with the sweepings of the Middle East, people from jail and from other units and that sort of thing. And it wasn't until we got a good draft from England of about 160 chaps, and the 2nd Battalion of the Green Hearts became the 1st Battalion, and we had the 1st Battalion colours and the silver, and some very good NCOs and officers and warrant officers joined us from England, that things began to look up.
Were you able to catch any of the rioters red-handed in Calcutta? Or did you
always... I don't recall that we did, no.
You always came after the riot had finished?
Yes. When we appeared, they stopped. There would be some shooting and things going on, and then as soon as the soldiers appeared, they would vanish. No, I don't think we did have any success in catching the rioters. I don't think so. I don't remember it.
Were the people who were perpetrating the riots in a frenzied state, or were they cold and calculating?
I think the idea was that the boundary between India and Bangladesh was to be either here or there or there, and the people in those areas were trying to establish that this was their area. So if the Muslims thought they ought to have this particular strip of territory because it had a rifle factory in it or it had some jute mills in it, they would try and slaughter all the Hindus and say, well, we're all Muslims here, so this should belong to Bangladesh. And similarly, the Hindus would do the same if they thought that they could establish that this was their territory and that all the Muslims didn't belong. They would try and slaughter all the Muslims and establish that this was India and not Bangladesh. It was political, I think, largely.
Did you ever have any conversations with any Indians about what was happening?
Oh, yes. Particularly where there would be some horrible incident in a Basti area, and our soldiers would be accused of having raped a girl or set fire to a house or something like that. One had to deal with these Bengali lawyers and people like that who appeared on the scene and accused us of being the cause of all the trouble. Also, we had Mr. Gandhi came down to Calcutta and talked to the local Muslim leader, whose name I cannot recall, and during the period of their talking together, all the riots calmed down, and as soon as they went away again, Mr. Gandhi went away again, they started up all over again.
Was the Muslim leader Jinnah or Surawardi?
Surawardi, not Jinnah. I never met Jinnah. It was Surawardi, I think. Yes, it was Surawardi.
Were your troops misbehaving in India?
No. No, I don't think so. They did go out with girls and that sort of thing, but no, I don't think so. Life was very difficult then. I had a bungalow in Barrackpore, and I had to have an armed soldier sleeping on the, in the premises when I wasn't there, sort of thing. And the battalion was down in Calcutta doing its duty, and the countryside and the people got very lawless. They would come over the river and clean out all the bungalows. We were robbed one night, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I had a pistol under my pillow and a sort of a knob carry under the bed, and I saw this figure in the doorway, and he'd pulled down the curtain and was just going to make off with everything wrapped up in the curtain when I woke up and chased him out. This is very unpleasant when you've had two small children in the house. It got to be very lawless and not what one had been brought up to believe was life in India, which was all tiger shooting, playing polo and that sort of thing.
Were you second in command or yes. The commanding officer?
I was first of all second in command, and I took over command of the battalion.
Whilst you're in Barrackpore?
Yes, yes. With no experience whatever of riot duty or anything like that, but I learned very quickly.
Did the troops ever have to open fire in Calcutta?
No, I don't think we ever did. No, we never opened fire. Our presence was enough, I think. Day, my wife and I were in Calcutta, and we drove back in a very small car with two armed soldiers, my wife and I in the back. We'd been to a cocktail party in the fort, I think, and the whole of the streets and the squares were simply full of thousands and thousands of Indians, thick on the ground, and they were all shouting and one thing or another, and it was all Jai Hind, India independence. And I said to the soldiers, for God's sake, don't do anything, don't open fire. And I just said, Jai England, and jollied along and joined in the thing. But it was a most frightening occasion, particularly for my wife sitting in the back there. And we eventually got back to Barrackpore all in one piece. But
what was Jai Hind Day? Hmm? What was Jai Hind Day?
Jai Hind? Hooray for India.
But what was this day?
What?
What was this particular day?
This was the independence granted to India by Mountbatten. And after that, we withdrew from Singapore, from Calcutta, and we let the Indians, I handed over to the command regiment, and we let the Indians carry on. We just went home.
Did any Indians express any regret at your leaving, or were they glad?
No, I don't think so. They were so pleased to be independent. They'd been all rioting about, go on, let us rule ourselves. No, they didn't express any regret at all. But mark you, our bearers and our servants expressed a great regret, because they had to get back to their homes, they'd lose their jobs, and I think a lot of them privately were very regretful because they respected what the British had done for India.